Like this. Why do we make our business, to dedicate time to Torah study? You know, like what is the goal behind that? A simple level. Any thoughts? No, you're not. There are a few of us so far. The link I originally sent, unfortunately, did not work out. I made a mistake. But hopefully, this other one will. So, I know this is a very basic question, but I think it's worth discussing. I think it's worth discussing specifically at a time like this. We have a few more people joining us, so we're going to... So, I think... Hi, Thomas, how are you? Doesn't look like... I think it's specifically worth discussing at a time like this because, you know, we're sort of compromised and such. And we're doing our best, you know, we're working with Zoom and other online platforms to get our classes going. You know, somewhere in the back of your head, there's probably a voice saying, what's the big deal? You know, it's okay. We'll take a break. And I'd like to discuss for a bit. It's a bit of an esoteric source, but I think it's a really important one. Generally about why we in Judaism are so adamant and enthusiastic about Torah study. So I don't know if you have the source sheet in front of you. I'm going to share the screen of the source sheet with you in just a second. Do you see it? Do you see the source sheet?
I have it on my other.
Yeah. Okay, there it is. Okay, so if you look at this first source, this is just about Torah study generally. And this is from the Baal HaTanya, Rishner Zalman of Laity, one of the first Chabad Rebbe. Have you heard of Chabad? Everyone knows Chabad, right? Chabad is a Hasidic sect that sets up in almost everywhere. They're just dedicated to helping the Jewish community generally. So this is, Rishner Zalman of Laity was one of the first of the Hasidic grand rabbis. He just has a systematic treatment of Jewish thought in general. And here he's talking about the unique experience of Torah study. And I thought we'd begin with this passage. So here we go, source one. So he says as follows. Now, when an intellect conceives and comprehends a concept with its intellectual faculties. Okay, so that means when you think about a concept and you comprehend that concept. This intellect grasps the concept and encompasses it. So now your mind has sort of encompassed this concept, right? When we think about anything, when you think about a math problem and you're grappling with it and you finally get it, I don't know, 6 times 4 is 24. Now your mind has encapsulated that concept. This concept is in turn grasped, enveloped, and enclosed within that intellect which conceived and comprehended it. So there's almost like a double-edged sword. The concept occupies your mind, right? You're thinking about it. When you think of something that really is it's thought-provoking, it sort of grasps your whole intellectual capacity. That's what you're thinking about. At the same time, when you get it, you've encapsulated that in your mind. So it's this union between your intellect and the concept. The mind, for its part, is also clothed in the concept at the time it comprehends and grasps it with intellect. For example, when a person understands and comprehends fully and clearly, it looks like my internet's not, is getting fuzzy, or no? Hopefully, do you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Hopefully that works. So, for example, when a person understands and comprehends fully and clearly any halacha law in the Mishnah or Gemara, it's the Talmud, or any part of Torah, so his or her intellect grasps and encompasses it, and at the same time is clothed in it. So now he's going to say, essentially address the following question. We have all sorts of interesting things in halacha, in Torah, that we study that don't seem to be too relevant, right? If you ever learn Talmud, all sorts of discussions about, you know, his ox gored her cow, and how much you have to pay, and you know, what if the cow was in public property? What if the cow is in private property? And you learn this and you're like, I don't have a cow, I don't have an ox, and I'm not a judge, and what is the relevance of any of this, right? You know, and hopefully we do try to pick topics which are relevant to our lives, but there are often topics in Torah which don't seem to be so immediately relevant. But the Rishner Zalman of Laity, the Baal HaTanya, is going to say it doesn't matter. And this is the reason why. Consequently, as the particular halacha is the wisdom and will of God, for it was His will that when, for example, Reuven pleads in one way and Shimon in another, the verdict as between them shall be thus and thus, even should such a litigation never have occurred, nor would it ever present itself for judgment in connection with such disputes and chains, nevertheless, since it has been the will and wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be He, that in the event of a person pleading this way and the other, pleading that way, the verdict shall be such and such. Now therefore, when a person knows and comprehends with his intellect such a verdict, in accordance with the law, as it is set out in the Mishnah, the Gemara, Poskim, the codes, he has thus comprehended, grasped, and encompassed with his intellect the will and wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be He. So what that means is, if we're learning about the Seder, we're going to talk about today what ingredients you need to bake matzah. So on a simple level, it doesn't seem like it's such a lofty concept. I mean, we're talking about making a food. We're talking about the ingredients that go behind it. We're going to talk about some important ideas related to those. But, you know, if you ask someone about what are the weightiest, most important things to discuss, most people wouldn't say, well, how to bake your matzah on Passover. But that being said, if you think about it a little more deeply, these laws of baking matzah, where do they come from? Well, they come from the Torah. What is the Torah? The Torah is the ideas of God. The Torah are God's ideas of how the world should work, and it's God's thought process. Now, sometimes you don't know why, quote-unquote, God has expressed these ideas to us. But what we believe in, the Torah belief is that whatever the concept is, that concept is the thought process of God. Therefore, when I think about that, when my mind is concentrated on those ideas, so my mind is concentrated on the thoughts of God. Right? Does everyone understand the concept where is it too lofty? Does everyone understand the concept we're talking about here? It's Bidas Tere. But not just, right, right. So that's essentially the point is that whatever it is, whether it's something relevant or not relevant, even if it doesn't seem to be, right, exactly. And now, the importance of that is as follows, though. Meaning you could say, okay, but I can connect to God through praying, I can connect to God through doing kindness. But here's the difference, okay? So you're connecting to the Holy Blessed Be He, who no thought can grasp, nor His will and wisdom, except when they are clothed in the laws that have been set out for us. Meaning, it's not just that you connect to God when studying Torah because this is His thought process. It's also that it's the only way to really access God's thought process. Meaning, we don't really understand God. We can't really comprehend the way God works or quote-unquote thinks or acts in the world. When He gave us the Torah, He said, this is how I think. That's the closest thing we have to understanding God. And He adds, so, since simultaneously the intellect is also clothed in them, this is a wonderful union like which there is none other, and which has no parallel anywhere in the material world, whereby complete oneness and unity from every side and angle could be attained. Okay? So I know it's a bit esoteric, but the point is, when we think about Torah, whatever it is, we are now, our thoughts, the God's thoughts are in our minds. And our minds, our mind grasps the thought grasps our mind. That is a very deep union between our minds and the mind of God. So my point is, I think it's important to think about these things. Although we're sort of, you know, each at our own place and in our houses, when we connect in this way, we're connecting, it's truthfully a deep religious and meaningful experience. What we're doing here is not just talking about how to bake matzah, but also we're discussing what God's opinions on the matter are, and we're looking together to understand God's thought process. And that, I think, is a seismic and meaningful experience. And I think that's part of why we continue to do what we do. Is that clear? Helpful? Okay, so I think this is something that's not always talked about. We sort of take it for granted. Yeah, Torah study, it's religious, this is what we do. But I think this does add another meaningful element to it. So to pick up on our discussion from last time, and please, if you have any questions, let me know, or if I start to lose you, if it's not clear, let me know. But we're going to do the best that we can. So our discussion last time was one that's, I think, something that comes up every year on Pesach and is a bit interesting. We're talking about, generally, we're talking about the very ambitious task that we try to accomplish on the Seder night, which is we don't only try to learn, it's not just educational, but it's experiential. We try to, in some way, see it as if we actually left Egypt. We try to experience an exodus ourselves. And not only do we do that, but we try to involve our children and grandchildren, who may have a bigger generational gap than we do, in that process. And that is quite an ambitious task. And what we talked about was that for that reason, since it is so ambitious, what we try to do on Leil Seder is that we try to involve the senses in that process, to make it something that we don't just think about or talk about, but feel. So last time we talked about different scenes of the Seder, our sense of sight. We talked about setting the table in a certain way. We talked about picking things up and putting them down. We talked about having props, the symbolism of the ke'arah, the Seder plate, as not just talking about the things that relate to Seder night, but also showing them. It's a show and tell type of experience. And the last thing we talked about briefly, which I wanted to explore more with you today, was the issue of stealing the afikomen. Okay, so if you look at source number 3, we discussed it last time, and in source number 2, I just brought to you, I got a lot of this material, I thought it was on an article written by Rav Aryeh Yitzhak Shevet for Hama'ayan, and I brought the link here for you on the source sheet. It happens to be in Hebrew, so it's for Hebrew speakers, but I just wanted to give him credit for some of what we're going to learn today. So to review, if you look at source number 3, the Talmud in Sachim says as follows, okay? It says as follows. Rabbi Lezer says, one grabs matzah on the nights of Passover on account of the children, so they ask questions and don't fall asleep. One grabs matzah. And we discussed last time, and which is sort of ambiguous, is what do we mean by grabbing matzah, and what is the goal of doing that? Why? Now, before we get to that, I'd actually like to ask you, because as we know, there's a custom of stealing the afikomen, right? I didn't have that growing up. In my house, we just hid the afikomen. But there are some families where the children will try to take the afikomen, which is one of the matzo we eat on the night of the Seder. It's the one we eat last, which we'll get to. And they steal it from their parents, and they hide it. And then, and if the parents find it, eventually the parents don't find it. They say, we're struggling, please tell us where it is, we need to eat it. And the children say, oh, well, we'll only let you know where it is if you buy us a present. Eventually it ends up with a trip to the store to get the present that the kids want. Are people familiar with this custom? Do you know this custom of stealing the afikomen? Yeah.
So I used to teach kindergarten at the high school.
Yeah.
And we're going back a long way, way before you were even born. And we had I can't remember whose custom it was. The custom was either that the father hid the matzah or the child hid the matzah. Whichever one was more Ashkenazi at the time was the one we followed. And I had a Moroccan mother come in, so we're going back over 40 years. We have a new influx of Moroccan Jews into Toronto, and she came quite agitated, the mother, and she said, "Could you please teach it both ways? That either the father steals the matzah, or the mother steals, or the child steals the matzah. I can't remember which one it was." And I said, "I have no problem with it," but I got called to the carpet by the head of the school, who said, "No, halachically, talmudically," and he gave me some passage. Who knows what it was? That it was either A or it was B. Can't remember which one.
Right. So we're going to see now We're going to see now, it does seem more like the parents steal from the children based on the Talmud. It does seem like that. But here's the question.
That was her argument, and he wouldn't let me teach it. I just didn't care.
That's interesting.
Again, it's a silly way, because you
lost the child in that. Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. So, I think these are customs, and they can evolve over time. Like, it's not like, you know, it's like any sort of commandment. It's just a way of getting people involved. Okay, there you go, exactly. So that's part of the point. But here's my question. Isn't this a bit risky educationally? This concept of stealing. Is that something that we avoid? Isn't that a bad sort of lesson to teach the kids?
I think it's more like a game.
Yeah. Right, I hear that. So that's what we're gonna see. It's a game. Do you think it's interesting though? And I think you're 100% right. We're gonna see that it's a part of it's supposed to make it fun. And I think part of what you're saying is that, and tell me if this is what you mean. I think what you might be saying is, you know what? Like maybe on a purely let's say rabbinic level, if you would ask your rabbi. They would say, you know, maybe this is sort of not the best way to teach your kid, you know, to get your kid involved. But I think what we're saying is that on the Seder night, we sort of up our game, right? We sort of do what we can. We're a bit more ambitious, maybe a bit more mischievous. It's worth it. It's worth the educational fallout, you know, obviously not encouraging stealing, but it's worth the educational fallout. It's worth the mischief. In order to get them involved and excited, I think we make that sacrifice on Seder night. Because, you know, the bottom line is we got to get them involved. I think that's the bottom line. Someone want to tell Thomas that. Thomas, your camera is on. Yeah. So, Linda, is. Sorry, what are you saying? Right, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly, yes.
For some things, these are allowed.
Right, so I agree. Meaning, I agree, I think fundamentally, if it was really stealing, then we wouldn't allow it. Like, if this was like a red line prohibition, then we wouldn't allow it, right? You know, stealing is, but this is not really stealing, as Linda said. This is a game, it's fun. Now, is it the best type of game to play? I don't know. But that being said, as you, Diana, and Linda are both saying, okay, it's something that we do on Seder night to make it different and special. I think, and every once in a while, it's okay to, you know, to have fun in a bit of a mischievous way. So how exactly does this work? If you look at source number four, what I'm going to say is that, as Diane said, it does seem to be more that the children are the victim of the stealing here in the Talmud. You know, as time evolved, it seems like it went the other way. It seems like the children were the stealers, not the people being stolen from. But it is very interesting to see how this happens. So if you look at in Maimonides in source number 4, he says as follows. On the first night of Pesach, one should introduce some change at the table, so the children who will notice it may ask, saying, why is this night different from all other nights? And he in turn will reply, this is what happened. Meaning you'll say, well, it's different because, you know, we left Egypt. In what manner, for example, should he introduce a change? He may distribute parched grain or nuts to the children, remove the table from its usual place, snatch the unleavened bread, the matzah, from hand to hand, and so on. So the Rambam interprets this idea of grabbing matzot as snatching them from hand to hand. What does it mean to snatch them from hand to hand?
It's the Wonder Bowl.
Yeah, it sounds like it's like, you know, who can get
the Wonder Bowl game.
Yeah, it's a game. It sounds like a game, right? It sounds like it, and it doesn't sound, by the way, like the way the Rambam has it, it doesn't sound like it's a one-time thing. It sounds like, no, this is something that might go on the whole Seder, you know, like. Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's rough. But yeah, that's what the Rambam sounds like saying. Like, look at source number 5. This is Yehonatan Akon of Luniel. He was a pretty early Rishon commentator on the Talmud from Provence. And he says as follows. And then again, this is commenting on what it means to snatch the matzot. One explanation is that the adults snatch the matzot from each other. So it's the adults. He's wondering here, is it the adults who are doing the snatching and being taken from, or are we taking it from the children? So the first explanation is, and this, I'm not sure that the Rambam, I think the Rambam sort of goes like this, that the adults take it from each other. It's a small demonstration of love of the mitzvah. I think what he means by love of the mitzvah, it's like, I want the matzah, because I love matzah so much. No, I want it, right? It's just like back and forth of grabbing the matzah, because, you know, to see who wants it the most. You know, I guess you'd hope this wouldn't evolve into violence, but it's a show of demonstration, a small demonstration we love, and the children are going to ask. And so for the children, so they don't ask, so they ask and don't fall asleep, right? We want them to ask, not to fall asleep. So that's, adjusted over here. that was the opposite. So they ask, they don't sleep that night, not the whole night, but until they hear the story. Right? Some explain that we, the adults, snatch it from the children and play with them. Right? It's a game with the kids. Alternatively, it means we eat quickly so the small children don't sleep and they recite Hallel with us. Right? This is a complete different explanation. So, what Rabbi Yonatan Cohen, I think Rambam is saying is, that we sort of, it's, you know, sort of getting their attention in a very direct and overt way. Now, I just want to take a step back for a second and think about the educational philosophy behind this and know that, you know, we have different children and different grandchildren. Kids are different. Some are very much active learners in that they learn when they see things or things are done. You know, it's the fun in the learning that gets their attention. And I think part of what we're saying on Seder night is, it's sometimes we need to make things fun, entertaining. Not only do we use the scenery sort of as like a tool of, this is what I'm talking about. It's not a show and tell. It's supposed to be fun. Kids need that. Some kids need the fun. Many kids need the fun in order to become engaged. Now, there's another interesting thing here, too. If you look at source number 6, I think we talked about this last time, and that is the Rashbam. And the Rashbam says that it means something different. It appears to me that snatching means removing the bread from the hands of the children, so they shouldn't sleep from eating too much, right? So what it sounds like it's saying, we don't let them eat. Imagine the children at the Seder table, And they want to eat. They're eating matzah because that's what you eat on Passover. And you say, no, that's enough. We can't eat too much today. Now think of it for a second. As a child, how would that make you feel? Right? You want to have your normal meal, and your parents say no because we don't want you to eat too much because you're gonna fall asleep. Like, what kind of reaction do you have to that? Right.
If you grew up in olden days, you would listen to your parents. If you grew up in today's generation, they'd tell you what that's too bad, and they'd go help themselves to the food.
Right. Exactly.
Comments between Rashbam's view of it and Rambam's view of it. Where one sounds like a very tough household and one sounds like a much more fun household.
Yeah. You know what? That's very interesting. It's very interesting because it translates into Rashbam. The Rashbam actually was a very serious fellow. We know that about him. He was sort of an ascetic. Yeah. And I agree with you, but what I would argue, and tell me what you think, what I would argue is that sort of both these perspectives are necessary, and I think it's always a balance of educating and being a parent. My child is actually just walking to the room. Hi, Miriam. So, I think it's... What?
I made my bed by
myself. Wow. Great job, Miriam. Thank you. Sorry about that. So I think a balance that we always try to strike as parents and grandparents is the balance between sort making things fun, making things happy, sort of going down to where the children are and being presentable and having a positive atmosphere. But also the balance of that is you have to know how to lay down the law and you have to know how to teach responsibility. And it's really
that's
you know
why the children are tasked with paying the money shtana. They have a job.
Right.
Their job at the Seder is to learn that money shtana till the cows come home.
Yeah, they got it.
That's their job.
100%. It's something that they have. The point is they got to do it.
That's right.
It's something that they have to do. I'll tell you as a child, this is the struggle. The struggle is you know you don't want to coerce your kids, but you have to teach them responsibility. I think the Rashbam and the Rambam and are sort of balancing these two poles of, on the one hand, fun, happy, creating the atmosphere the kids want to. But on the other hand, parenting can only be, look how wonderful life is, do what you think is fun and enjoyable, and that's what life is. It's all about enjoying yourself. No, life's also about responsibility. Life's also about what we need to do, being a responsible person. Being a productive person. And the Rashbam is saying, you know, you gotta, once a year, you tell your kid, you know, I know you love to eat, and often eating makes you tired and you like to take your nap after your meal, but tonight we're gonna stay up.
But we tell them that in Yom Kippur too. We tell them, I know you like to eat, but today you're not gonna eat till 12 or
10, yeah.
Jump or whatever. So a lot of what we're teaching them in all these holidays is not only how to follow Jewish traditions, but to follow responsibilities for life.
Yeah, 100%. And I think this custom sort of demonstrates both of those ideas. So to sort of end off, I think we have the Ritva here. The Ritva, known as Riontov ben Avram Ashavili. And he talks about the custom of Nachmanides. And here, I think what he's sort of emphasizing is the more intellectually curious child, right? Look at what he says here. The custom of Nachmanides was that when children were in the house and they removed the Seder plate, he would tell the waiter, let's recite grace after meals, for we ate so much, right? So it's 10 o'clock at night, you know, maybe in another year when this will happen. Looks like not this year, right? So, but... 10 o'clock at night, and you're waiting to eat your meal, and everybody's hungry, and you're about to begin the main long part of the Seder, and then you tell your kid, okay, that was nice, that was a good meal. Let's recite grace after meals. And the kid's going to be like, what? Like, I'm so hungry. Hey, Thomas, have you raised your hand? Okay. I'm so hungry. Right? Like, why are we, what are you talking about? So that the children would see and ask. Now says Rabbi Yom Tov, I think snatching matzah means that as they reach to take the matzah, we snatch it from their hands and say, you ate a lot. That's what it means. Hey, you gotta be done eating by now. Come on, you ate so much. And that's what it means. We steal the food from them. So again, a sort of a different emphasis, not on just making it a game, but trying to trick them and saying, you know, they know that this is the beginning of the meal, but you're telling them it's not. And I think this also sort of relates to the fact that kids learn differently. And that while some kids may enjoy a good game of Steal the Matzah, for other kids, that might be a bit much for them. It's more about, you know, sort of doing it intellectually, piquing their curiosity, doing things that are a bit different to make them ask questions. It doesn't need to be the action-packed game of the Rambam. It could be more of one time, just, you know, take the kid and say something to them. I guess we're done eating for now. And I think this idea, it shows that you need to be, as educators, as we are of the Seder, we need to be in tune to the needs, educational needs of our children, and to know that people learn differently and are engaged differently. And these different approaches to this custom of snatching the matzah address these different perspectives and approaches to getting the kids involved. So that is the discussion about snatching the matzah. And that is how our discussion of the sense of sight in the Seder, the scenes of the Seder. And now I'd like to talk about the taste, the power of taste. And I'd actually like to ask you a question. And it's gonna be a trick question, but to ask as follows: what holidays have specific foods associated with them? What would you say?
Hanukkah, Purim.
Hanukkah, Purim, right? Hanukkah, we eat latkes. Purim, we eat hamantaschen. And right, apple and honey and Rosh Hashanah. So. Is it a strange thing to have specific foods for a holiday in Judaism?
Yeah.
Who says yeah?
Me.
You think it's strange?
Go together.
What'd you say?
We're Jewish. Jews and food go together.
Yes, that's not strange at all, right. So on the one hand, 100%, almost every food, every holiday, at least some customary food associated with it. Shavuot, you could say dairy and cheesecake. Rosh Hashanah's apple and honey. Yom Kippur obviously does not. You know, that's the exception because we don't eat. But if we could, we would definitely have a Yom Kippur food.
But every religion has that.
Right.
About the Muslims, at the end of Ramadan, they always start with dates. You
know, interesting. Interesting. And that very well could be. Now, but I'm going to ask you another question, which is a bit different, which is, which holidays are we actually mandated, where there's an actual quote-unquote obligation to eat a specific food? And what I mean by that is...
Only Pesach,
right? All the other holidays, it's a custom, it's a nice idea. It sort of develops. It doesn't say anywhere that you must eat latkes on Pesach. It doesn't say anywhere on Rosh Hashanah. You know, the apple and the honey is a sign for a sweet new year. You know, these are customs that develop later on. There's no mandate. It doesn't say anywhere in the Bible that on Rosh Hashanah you should eat apple and honey. There's one day a year, in my opinion. It seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, there's one day a year where we're actually told to eat a specific type of food. And that is Pesach. There is no other, you know, you could say bread, we eat bread different times of the year, but bread isn't really for the bread itself, it's because bread is symbolic of a more formal feast. You know, that's the way that's how the rabbi saw it, that if you're having a big meal, you know, you have bread. Nowadays, you know, people who are trying to keep low-carb diets would probably disagree with that idea. You know, no, avoid bread. But that's how it was seen. Bread means a formal festive meal. But aside from that, I can't think of another time in the year where we're actually obligated to eat a specific type of food, aside from Passover. And on Passover, it's not just that it's many. There's matzah, there's maror. You know, there's haroset, which we'll maybe mention a bit in passing today, but that karpas are specific types of food that we're supposed to eat as part of the halachic process. It's ritual. This is part of what we do. And that's really interesting. That's something I want to think about. Why Passover of all days? Now, that's number one. Number two is that it's not just that we're supposed to eat these specific foods, is that it's also that we're supposed to experience a certain taste. Someone asked a question? I missed something? Sorry. So, we have to taste those foods. The taste is an emphasis. Take a look at verse number 8. This is from the Talmud and Psachim, and it says as follows. And this is a bit disappointing for some people in the crowd. Let me ask, who here enjoys eating maror?
Well, ours is lettuce, so we're fine.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? That's the thing. But as a child... As a child, and I think this is not uncommon, everybody detests the maror, right? So what do? If you want to sort of make it more palpable or make it, deal with this obligation. So what do? So some people will dip it in the charoset and they'll eat them at the same time. Now, believe it or not, that might not be the way it's meant to be done. If you look at source number 8, it says as follows. Rav Papa said, a person should not leave bitter herbs in the charoset for a lengthy period of time, lest the sweetness of the spices in the charoset nullify its bitterness. And the bitter herb requires a bitter taste, and they are not bitter when marinated in charoset. At the end of that is sort of the commentary from the English edition here. But the point is, you're supposed to taste the bitterness of the maror. It's supposed to taste bitter. You're not supposed to sort of reduce the bitterness and alleviate that. It's supposed to be bitter. If you look at number 9, this is the Code of Jewish Law from Yosei Karo, and where he says that you're supposed to shake off the charoset for that reason. You're not supposed to eat them together. You're supposed to taste the bitterness. Now, this leads to an interesting halakhic discussion in the Talmud, which is as follows, and I'd like to know what you think about this. What if a person swallows these foods whole? Yeah, what if we just ingest them? I don't know, it's probably challenging, I wouldn't recommend it just from in terms of not choking, but what if you did? What if you didn't taste them?
If I just took a swallow of pork, then I really wouldn't be eating trace.
So that's part of the question. So that's part of the question. Is swallowing considered eating? And if it is considered eating, should there be any problem doing that on Seder night when we have to eat these foods? So if you look here, it actually is interesting. Says the Rava in source number 10. Rava said, if one swallowed matzah without chewing it, he has fulfilled the obligation to eat matzah as he has consumed it. However, if one swallowed bitter herbs without chewing them, he has not fulfilled his obligation as he did not taste their bitterness. Furthermore, if one swallows matzah and bitter herbs together, he has fulfilled the obligation of eating matzah. But he has not fulfilled the obligation of eating bitter herbs. So three laws here. If you swallow matzah, that's okay, which is interesting.
Why?
What do you... why is it not okay if you swallow maror? What would you say?
Because you didn't taste it, you didn't bite it, you didn't taste the bitter.
Right.
That's his argument.
It sounds like it. Right. So what does that tell you about matzah, though? What does that tell you about matzah? It sounds like if you swallow matzah, that is okay.
Right.
Which, it sounds like it's less about the taste. Now, that's kind of interesting.
Except if you swallow matzah, later.
So you're saying we feel bad for you, so we're not going to make you do it again. Right. So, but I found this very interesting, really. It sounds like from this source, that the taste of maror is more imperative. Tasting the matzah, I'm sure, is recommended, but it sounds like you can get away with just eating it, which relates to Diane's point about pork, right? It sounds like swallowing is eating, it's just not tasting. And on the Seder night, we need to taste. And the question is, why is the taste so necessary? Now, what's also interesting, it says if you eat them together, that also works for matzah, but not for maror. And finally, if one wrapped matzah and bitter herbs in a palm net, this is the commentary of the thin interlacing of vines that sprouts around a palm tree, and swallow them, then that you have not fulfilled your obligation of even matzah. right? So if you sort of wrap it around in some non-edible object and ingest it that way, and the food doesn't even encounter your palate, then that's not eating at all. But, so, at first glance, I would think that this source is telling me that to swallow matzah is okay, but to swallow maror is not okay. However, and that is how some commentators interpret this Talmud, this passage in the Talmud. There is another approach, which is interesting, and that is that some argue that it's not that you don't need to taste matzah, and you do need to taste maror. Some actually argue, some have the opposite text in this Gemara, and they say that it's the opposite, and that if you swallow maror, that works because you're going to taste it anyway. And if you swallow, because it's so intense. And if you swallow matzah, that's not okay, because if you swallow it, you won't taste it. That's what some have in this Gemara. If you look at source number 11, the Rambam has a different interpretation of what happens in the third case, and I think it's worth thinking about. He says in source 11, if one swallowed matzah, he has fulfilled the obligation. If he swallowed bitter herbs, he has not fulfilled it. If he swallowed matzah and bitter herbs, like one, he fulfilled matzah, he did not fulfill bitter herbs, as the bitter herbs are like something auxiliary to the matzah. And I think this is, the point is, it's not just that you don't taste the maror, it's that maror is sort of subservient. When eaten together, you sort of lose that unique experience. And this is something that I think is important to think about. It's not just the taste itself, is that it's the diametrically opposed themes of matzah and maror, which are the main things we need to eat. You know, part of the point here is that they seem to be two different experiences. It's about the taste and the experience of the taste. Putting them together might then dilute the experience. And the Meiri actually argues that that he just says that some people say that this passage of the Talmud is an operative because of course you need to taste the matzah. That's the whole, you know, we talk about that a lot on Pesach. So I think what you see from these sources, I know it gets a bit technical, but I think what you see from these sources is that this idea of taste is an important one and something worth thinking about. And the question sort of is, how imperative is taste? Is it about, you know, do we say if you didn't taste the food, then you didn't get the point of it, you missed the point? Or is it sort of an additional and important component, but not essential? These are the questions that are being dealt with here. And I think what it's...
But what about
if you have a what, sorry? Exactly. Korech, right. So Korech, this is a big discussion. When we talk about whether or not you should actually, we do both, right? We combine the matzah with the maror and eat that as a sandwich, and like Hillel said to do it. But we also just eat the matzah and maror separately by themselves. Part of the discussion is, if you combine them, are you diluting the taste too much? And the question is, what exactly, how are we to understand this role of taste? Why is it that the taste is so essential? And to answer that, I'd like to actually begin another discussion, which I think, and we'll bring it back here, we'll try to move a little bit quicker here. And that is the question of, what should matzah taste like? If I were to ask you, you know, what type of taste should a person have when they eat matzah? What's the goal? What is the experience of eating matzah supposed to, how should that feel for us when we eat matzah? What are the feelings associated with it?
Dry.
Dry, okay. Is that surprising? Right, matzah is usually bland. Now, that's kind of interesting. If you were to say, you know, we had this festival where we celebrate leaving Egypt and our freedom, what kind of food would be the hallmark of that holiday?
Well,
Something, right. Why cake?
Something other than something dry and tasteless.
Right. It's strange. It's very strange. Why would we pick something sort of bland and dry for the...
You could argue, though. I mean, we have this whole thing that, you know, when we left Egypt, we were like being reborn, the whole imagery of rebirth.
Right.
When babies are born, what do we feed them? The most boring, blandest food in the world.
Interesting.
So we are now just being reborn and eating exactly as if we were new babies.
Interesting.
May I suggest another answer?
Yes.
I think I'm going to ask another question, which is, you would think that you should start the entire evening with matzah. This is the centerpiece. We'll do Kiddush, right away we'll do matzah, and we'll get right into this. We won't eat anymore.
Right.
So we can have matzah. Why do we have it and meal? And I think the point is, matzah is really, it's not even a neutral. It's a nil. It's fill it in with what you want. So it's a continuation of the learning process.
Interesting.
Eating is part of understand why you're eating. And that's why we do matzah there. And something just occurred to me. Was there anybody else helps me with this? I just realize if you think of the three letters in matzah, starts with a mem. And a hay, and a tzaddik in the middle. So let's take out the tzaddik, please, with ma.
What
is this that I'm eating? And really, that's the only real rational answer to that, which is, what am I eating? Why am I eating it? What's the narrative? Because there's no way I would eat this if there wasn't some story behind it. Like, I ate this hot dog also when I saw the Brooklyn Dodgers last week of the World Series. You know, something like that. I got to have a really good reason to eat this. And the tzaddik is one of those weird letters that actually is a word like I and is the I that we're all sitting here now.
Yeah, well, I love the idea, Moish. I love the idea. And to your point, in the middle of the Seder, we say Al Shum Ma. We talk about why do we eat the matzah? Why do we have Pesach, the sacrifice, the Paschal sacrifice? We don't have it anymore, but we still say that. And why do we have, and Al Shema, for what? For what? We ask that question explicitly in the Seder. And you're sort of saying that that's not just sort of clarifying. It actually defines, you know, what our experience would be, because that's what matzah is there for. It's sort of neutral. So I'm actually...
Can I make another point?
Yeah, sure, of course.
I don't think people understand that matzah is the great... I mean, the mitzvot of Pesach are the greatest mitzvot that we have from before the Torah.
Right, interesting.
I mean, the Torah is codified, but it's essentially a non-mitzvah experience in the sense of how we know mitzvot. The mitzvot are codifying what happened, a story, an experience. And that's what the whole evening is about, an experience. You even look at the story of the five rabbis together. Even Shema is out of their heads. They need their time to come and say, time for Shema, guys.
Right. Anyways. Right.
That's my thought.
It's very primal. It's like almost like a primal obligation. Right. So I think we're going to see a few perspectives on what the Tesha should be. I want to ask, since it is 11 o'clock, we started a bit late, but do people want to hold here and pick up the rest of this discussion for next time, or you have a few more minutes?
I'm fine.
Everyone's good? Okay, so we'll go to 11:10. I don't want to go. So... So we, you know what? Well, let me do some more outside here. So I'm gonna just go back. I'm gonna leave the screen here with the source sheet, and we'll just do more face to face talking. So what you find, which is really interesting, is different interpretations of this idea that matzah is lachma anya, right? We're matzah is known as what? The bread of often the bread of what? Oni, which means.
Suffering,
affliction, poor, right? Now, this is a really interesting notion. Why should matzah be considered the bread of affliction? I always learn affliction. Affliction is a very negative sort of association with the term. So in what sense is that? Is the matzah a bread of freedom or affliction? Now, some will say it's both. But some are going to argue that no, matzah is all about freedom. Maror is affliction, and that's part of the question. Now, if you look in source number 13, if you have it in front of you, but I'm just going to say it outside. So that we say, again, that it's the bread of destitution, according to this translation, that our ancestor ate in the land of Egypt. And that's from the beginning of the Maggid ceremony. But I'm going to argue that it's not clear that the word destitution is the right translation of the word oni. Oni, the Hebrew letters Aleph Vav Nun Yud, actually is interpreted in many different ways. So, look at source 15. 14, I brought you the passage, but so in the Gemara itself gives a number of different explanations which don't necessarily relate to destitution. So one is, it's from the word onet, la'anot, which means to recite, to answer. That matzah is the centerpiece of all the things we discuss on the night of the Seder. It's a springboard for discussion. That's what it would be more accurate to say, the bread of discussion. Then we have another opinion, which is that you eat a bit at a time. You take a piece of the matzah off, right? And you don't eat the whole thing at once, which is an interesting idea. And that's just like a poor person eats a bit at a time. So it means the bread of a poor person. Just like a poor person saves some of the matzah for later. So too, on the last Seder, we don't eat the whole thing at once. We break off a piece and eat that. We take a prusa, a piece. And then you have another idea, which is that you have to bake it quickly. And that's what matzah relates to. As poor people do. Now, there are those commentators who argue, indeed, that matzah is indeed the bread of affliction. That part of what we remember when we eat matzah is that we were slaves and suffered. The Rajasvarno, I have it here in source number 16, says that, well, why do we eat matzah? As the Torah sort of discusses itself, that we were in a rush to leave Egypt. And since we were in a rush, we were rushed out. We were subject to external pressure. And it wasn't just then that we had external pressure. Matzah reminds us of the constant external pressure we experienced in Egypt, that we were always being rushed and told what to do. And that's why we eat it. Which means that what does matzah remind us of? Slavery. That matzah reminds us of slavery. Now, it also, you could argue, and maybe it's both. You could argue it's a dual symbolism. It's matzah reminds us of the slavery of Egypt. It's also the freedom because it's when we left. But it's complicated, which I think sort of reflects back to Moshe's point, which is that maybe it's sort of, you know, fill in the blank. Maybe matzah sort of reminds us of whatever we're feeling at that time. It is this bland food. It's just sort of flexible. The taste of it is sort of neutral. And maybe you can sort of insert the, you know, feeling that you have. Right? Now, that being said, there is another approach to this. I think it's one I'd like to leave you with, and it's worth considering. So the Rambam says that, talks about what you need to, what ingredients you need to bake matzah. Okay? And he says as follows. He says, but only fulfills the obligation of eating matzah as if he ate it from one of the five species of grain. That matzah needs to be made from wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye. Those are the ingredients that we use to make the flour. And it needs to be something that could have become chametz. Okay? Now, here's the important point, though, at the end of source number 17. One may fulfill his obligation on Passover with matzah needed with fruit juice, but we may not need it with wine, oil, or milk on account of bread of poverty, as we explained. So in talking about the ingredients one needs to bake matzah, the Rambam says here, because matzah is lechem oni, it's the bread of poverty, you don't add extra or sweet ingredients to it. That's what lechem oni means. Lechem oni means it's just the flour and the water. Lechem oni means no sugar. Lechem oni means no fruit juice. Actually, it sounds like fruit juice is okay, which is interesting. But it sounds like you can't add wine, you can't add oil, you can't add milk. That's what lechem oni means. Wine, oil, or milk. Now, what's interesting is, it's not chametz. It doesn't mean that you can't eat it. It just means that if you want to fulfill your obligation on Passover of eating matzah, you can't use this type of sweet bread with additional ingredients. You can't, right? You can't have... Right.
Well, you're
not supposed to
use it like for the bracha.
Exactly. Because it's not lechem oni, bread of the poor. So what is the idea then? If bread of the poor is there to mean, if it's there to exclude bread baked with oil or wine or honey, what is this idea? So the Maharal, and this is what I wanted to share with you, just reviewed alone, in source number 18, is a really interesting idea. And I think it's actually one that's relevant to us now. And he says as follows, right? Lechem oni, says the Maharal. Matzah is not bread of the affliction. Says the Maharal, matzah is only there to represent redemption and freedom. It is not associated with slavery. That's maror. Matzah is bread of freedom. If that's so, then why is it that it's called bread of the poor? Says the Maharal, the point there is to contrast it with what we call matzah ashira, rich bread. Rich bread, says the Maharal, means matzah that you add extra ingredients to. Bread that you add extra ingredients to. Are you still with me?
Lost you,
eh? You hear me or no?
Okay.
Okay. So let's, because since we're losing the connection, let's include this. Says the Maharal as follows, that bread of the poor means it's you only have the essentials. That's what matzah means. Matzah means you just have bread, water, and flour, and nothing else, because that's all that you need. That's you. Rich man's bread means additional ingredients. Rich man's matzah shira, the bread of the wealthy. Rich matzah means adding additional agreed ingredients. Bread of the poor means just the basics. Now, why would we want to eat just the basics on Pesach? Says the Maharal, it's about being independent. It's about being able to stand on our own. It's about not being encumbered, not being attached to other things or others. Because that's what freedom is really about. Freedom, says the Maharal, is being able to function as an independent person and not requiring or being subservient or attached to others. Ah, so that's obviously the good question, and so the corollary is then being. I think the argument would be that being a servant or attached to God, aside from being what we're here for, ultimately it enables you to be the best that you can be, because you know that being attached to God is seen as being the ultimate expression of yourself. We're meant to be God's emissaries in this world. But it is quite an interesting point you're bringing up. It's this stark contrast. The freedom of Pesach, as we say, when Moshe says he wants to leave. Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." He doesn't just say, "Let my people go." It's, "Let my people go and serve God." Right? And I think their point there is that we acknowledge there is a purpose and goal and mission in life. When we say freedom, freedom doesn't mean freedom to do whatever you want. Freedom means that you choose the life that you decide is best for you to live. And other people don't interfere with that decision. And being servants of God in this perspective is, we're arguing, the best way to live life. But your point, it is strike quite a contrast. You're making a good point, Diane. Just to sort of conclude, what the Maharal says is that the bread of the affliction, part of it, the taste of matzah, is the taste of freedom because it's so plain. The plainness of it, which is similar to what Moshe was saying before, but a bit differently. Because it's bland, because it's just the basics, it's just the essentials, that is why it's the taste of freedom. Because freedom means being free to be who you are and not being encumbered by other things that take up your time and require you to be someone different. And that's what part of the idea here is. So I actually think that's very relevant to the current predicament that we're in. You know, being sort of isolated and in our own houses and not moving. So it gets back to the basics, right? It gets back to, like, what do I actually need? Being able to be, if there is sort of like a positive aspect of this, it's this idea that we can be quote unquote free in this sense, free and freeing ourselves from some of the things that we rely on, freeing ourselves from the need to go out and get, you know, all the things that we usually are used to. Now, again, I'm not saying this is something that, you know, we want to continue. Obviously, we want to get back to our normal lives and to get back to the ability to go out and live the way we like to. But I think something to think about in this current predicament is, what are the basic essentials of my life and who I am? Like, what actually defines me? And what actually defines my life and what I need for it? And being in sort of in your house lends itself to that type of contemplation and introspection. And that's part of what we're going for on the Lost Seder. It is the simplicity. It is the independence of things that are unnecessary that encumber us otherwise. And we can be a slave to ourselves in a certain sense if we're not free to make the choices we think are best for ourselves. And if we're encumbered by other things that weigh down on our thought process. And I leave you with, we'll end with this Rambam over here, where he talks about the idea that the last thing you're supposed to eat on Seder night is, during the time when we had the temple, was the Paschal sacrifice, the Karban Pesach. And nowadays, the last thing you're supposed to eat on Leil HaSeder is the Afikomen, that last piece of matzah. And the Rambam says, because you're supposed to leave the Seder night with the taste of the mitzvot, the taste of the commandments, the taste of the Seder in your mouth. That should be what's on your palate, the taste of Seder night. And I think that the idea of taste, the reason why we emphasize it, is because taste is a tool we use to take an experience with us, to make something have a lasting impact, right? If you go out to a good meal, you eat, something you enjoy, your friends, and you enjoy company with your family, which you can't do, unfortunately, now. It's a positive experience. What do we say about that? You still have the taste of that experience in your mouth. You leave with the taste of it. So long as that lingers, and the impact of Seder night is not just a one-night experience, but it's something that you can bring with you. And I think that's part of what we're doing, focusing on the taste of it, the taste of the maror, the taste of the matzah, the taste of all the things we eat on Seder night, is to make it, that impact, a lasting impact, that it should affect us and should bring that Pesach Seder experience of freedom past just Seder night to the rest of the year as well. And I think that's part of what we're trying to accomplish, not just having this transcendent experience, but also impacting our lives the rest of the year. So that's where we're going to pause here for today. I want to apologize for all the communication errors and the wrong link before, but I do commend everyone for doing our best to make this happen and continue our discussion, continue our thought, our union with the thoughts of God. And I wish everybody a great day. We should all be able to cope and continue to communicate as best as we can, and have health and happiness. And Meretz Hashem, with the help of God, we'll continue next week at this time. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Absolutely.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Thanks.